This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Today is the Friday recap where we revisit a few of the most interesting conversations we had this week. Up first, we'll take a deep dive on the technology and promises behind cryptocurrencies and blockchains. A reminder, this show is not live. We're joined by Aniket Kate, an associate professor of computer science at Purdue University. Thank you so much for joining us, Aniket.
Thanks for having me.
There's a lot to get into here. So I guess we'll start with the topic we mentioned that most people listening know something about or have heard something about by this point in time, which is cryptocurrencies. When did cryptocurrency first get started?
So the term cryptocurrency is fairly new. I would say that maybe the term started to get employed maybe 7 or 8 years ago in the form of Bitcoin as the prominent players were there. However, the concept of performing currency or payment operations via cryptography, via making sure that we have authenticity of those transactions, is fairly old, maybe 90s, where it was initially thought as a helpful tool for banking environment in terms of the products such as digital cash.
What was the initial reason cryptocurrency was created? You said it was as far back as the 90s. I guess I'm wondering what purpose it served then and if it's changed to what it's being used for now.
We are getting surprised with all things. Indeed, in 90s, the idea there was, can we have an environment where we have currencies or we have payment mechanisms available which are complementary to the existing dollar transactions or euro transactions, where our accounts and our payments are not only just maintained on our banking system on a ledger, but in fact, there could have a independent presence where another system keep track of all this information. And in some environment, in a better privacy-preserving manner, so that no one entity, one bank, or one environment can figure out who is performing transaction with whom. So privacy was indeed one of the main driver in early days. But when Bitcoin came in 2009 and actually got started in 2010 onwards, there it was actually came from a different angle, where the idea was that rather than having a single government or governing entity making decisions about how the money is spent and how it is created and distributed, can we have a decentralized or distributed control on that so that anybody who wants to become part of the governance of a currency will be able to join and become part of the governance? So that was one of the basic idea behind Bitcoin was that. And as we make progress to now, there are all sort of different examples that are emerging, including even our own centralized banks all over the world themselves are also considering what are known as central bank digital currency initiative.
How would you explain this to folks who are listening that are wondering, like, what would Bitcoin or cryptocurrency do for them? How useful is it for them in their day-to-day lives?
So one of the key driver in the early days of aspects such as Bitcoin was that it allows one to perform transactions going beyond the geographical boundaries that were present in a manner so that it's not restricted by any sort of centralized agency that could have been present over there. Because it's a ledger that is maintained on the internet, in a way, it could be simply looked at, if I can send an email to somebody, I'm not restricted by any means by, it's not that when I'm sending an email that I have to wait for a day or two for that email to reach there. It is instantaneous process. Or if I send a message, it can be instantaneous process. On other hand, with our existing payment infrastructure, the payments even across the borders or just within system itself can take a significant amount of time. And what Bitcoin and other environment initially offered was efficiency towards performing transactions, where your transaction time it takes to perform your transaction is no longer limited by geographical or other regulatory means.
So you can get something within seconds versus waiting days.
That was the aim. But there is a catch over here in that respect. Indeed, I can see the transaction, let's say you paid me, that it is actually getting added to the system in seconds. But if you consider a system like Bitcoin, even to get the transaction get added to the ledger, it could easily take 10 minutes at least if the network is not congested. Or even you may have to wait for longer, around up to an hour, to ensure that such a transaction indeed finish. But that's where a majority of the innovation has been happening in last 7 to 8 years, where currencies beyond Bitcoin are trying to improve this latency to the level of seconds or even milliseconds.
Right. Yeah. There's just so many different types of cryptocurrency out there. I keep hearing about new ones getting started. And then sometimes there's fake ones that people get kind of sucked into without realizing. Before we get into some of that stuff, I'm curious, what is it about Bitcoin that has made it arguably the most prominent cryptocurrency out there?
Indeed. So the success of Bitcoin surprised many, and including myself. I remember myself as a graduate student doing my PhDs in this area of cryptography and distributed systems. And this paper came up from an unknown, actually a pseudonym, and whom we still do not know who the author is. And realizing that this is all good. We knew many of things already. The timing was kind of a right for Bitcoin. What helped Bitcoin in its earlier days was this idea that anybody who wants to become part of the governing a currency can join it. They can become so-called miners, if you heard this term. And you can also then perform transactions in such environment. Essentially, there is no, your name never appears on such a ledger. You are only represented there by what is known as a wallet address, which is basically something known as a public key from the cryptography terms, which is a public identifier for you. But you can create any number of such public identifier. So there was also inherent privacy aspect to that that was used. Later, how I'll see that an early 3 to 4 years, the idea was indeed, it was indeed more popular among the enthusiasts with this whole environment of digital currency. But in spite of all the hiccups that Bitcoin saw in the early year, the technology and the underlying concepts found to be sound. And that actually got more people interested into such environment where it offers a nice alternative or a complementary technology to all the things that we are performing today. And many people look today as that as a sound investment. And that got started maybe from 2015 onwards. People also observe that the same technology can be employed beyond finances to supply chain, to track and all other applications, and that gave even further boost. So that's how I will say the journey started. Initially, it was privacy and the independence of the governance, but later the stability of the technology is what attracted people.
You mentioned the privacy, and I don't know, I guess I had a misconception. I thought using cryptocurrency would be more transparent. So is the use of privacy a concern for some that, you know, some bad actors might be using cryptocurrency to do things?
So I would like to answer this question two ways, because it's a very interesting question. And I use the term initially for privacy for Bitcoin. In fact, as it turns out now, it is considered that if you're using something like Bitcoin, then your privacy is even weaker than our current environment that we where we use the current our banking systems. Because the ledger is transparent and available to everybody to observe. And there are all sort of linking attacks that have been thought through so that we can figure out which transactions coming from which ID. And then eventually when you connect the ID in the Bitcoin world or blockchain world to an identifier, let's say outside a blockchain world in our environment through exchanges where we, let's say, convert dollar to Bitcoin. And that link can be employed now to establish all the transactions that you perform in Bitcoin kind of environment. And there are already firms which actually expertise, and they are active for several years now to dealing with this privacy, basically attacking the privacy on the Bitcoin kind of environment. At the same time, there are newer currencies that came up where the aim was to improve the privacy in such an environment so that privacy continued to remain available to the level of our current centralized banking environment, or probably even better than that in some instances. On other hand, when you talk about the issue of that privacy being used as a hiding place for illegal activities, it's certainly has been a small concern with this environment, but I find that many times it's overhyped in the sense that even with our current centralized environment, all sort of money laundries and other issues and tax evasion have been equally effective and active. When we look at the digital currency, it's another instrument with its own features and not so nice features. And in general, it has issues, but so far we have observed that all the regulation agencies have been successful to figure out issues when it comes to the money laundering and other irregularities that typically happens in such environments.
I just remember hearing a lot about different companies that get hacked, and then those bad actors will say things like, we need to be paid in Bitcoin if you want your files back.
Yes, so that certainly is something do happens for the ransomware attacks where your system get hacked and then they ask you for making payment in Bitcoin. As it turns out, even there are examples where the money got recovered from such environment, because if they use Bitcoin as the example, we precisely know where money is going, which address it is going to, and how it is making, transfer in the Bitcoin environment itself. And once you see an exit point, you precisely know where it's going. So they use it, but I don't think that's always going to be the case that remains their preferred means. So at the same time, I will say that even before or even without Bitcoin, with the standard currencies, such ransomware attacks could be performed, where now they may try to just tell you to perform transaction in a currency, in a foreign currency, and that could be much more a complex issue for an organization to deal with.
If you have any questions or comments, reach out to us on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. I'm Miriam Soap. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Soap. We're learning the ins and outs of 5G technology, how it affects us, and why there's so much conversation around it. With us are Meng Chang, Executive Vice President of Purdue University and Dean of the College of Engineering, and Nick Lanneman, Director of Spectrum X, Co-Director of the Wireless Institute and Professor of Electrical Engineering at the University of Notre Dame. Before the break, we were kind of touching upon creating these infrastructures and getting people to come and I guess invest in the area and bring their stuff here. But Meng, do you think Indiana's prepared for that?
Well, Miriam, let me first address the question you asked before the break, and that is all these generations, what about 10G at some point? Well, think of a pendulum and think of snow, right? Part of, I think, my answer is that the pendulum does swing back and forth. Like 15 years ago, everybody started saying, everything goes to the cloud, and the edge is going to be a dumb edge. When now, over the past several years, you see the pendulum start to swing back towards the edge compute, and people say, well, maybe the click, the brick trade-off, there is something to be said about moving services and capabilities closer to the end users and things. But also think of the snow. There is something to be said about piling on and on. At some point, people will say it costs money to buy spectrum, it costs money to upgrade equipment, and it costs us money as consumers to buy new end-user devices. So when will this stop? When you shuffle the snow, right, you look at layer after layer, if it's too many layers, say, wow, this is too much. Well, I think there is a case to be made that the spectrum might be dynamically shared and the infrastructure might be sliced and shared so that each operator, whether it's a cloud provider, a telco company, can save a little bit as they keep piling on new generations. Now, as to whether Indiana is ready, I think the answer is absolutely yes. For one, Indiana has a deregulated small cell deployment environment. Part of the trend of edge compute is to get the cell towers closer to the end users, but transmitting with much less power as well. And some cities around the country, it takes so much money and time to get a permit. That's not the case here in Indiana. And furthermore, we've got great universities and entrepreneurs, including those at Notre Dame and Purdue, for example, that can innovate on spectrum, on infrastructure, and to attract application. That's the key. If we can attract more application providers to come right on our 5G waves in Indiana, then we have a very strong case.
Nick, I'm curious your thoughts.
Yeah, I would echo a lot of what Meng said. I think Indiana is very well positioned. We've got some leading universities. He mentioned Notre Dame and Purdue, and IU is also heavily involved in exploring this space. We've got Crane Naval Base and a number of defense contractors out in Fort Wayne, Indiana. South Bend is a manufacturing hub, and it has only barely started to touch utilizing 5G and related technologies for the manufacturing processes here. Meng has mentioned the Indiana 5G zone in Indianapolis. There's also the Wabash Heartland Innovation Network, which is all focused on making intelligent, smart agriculture and rural broadband. There's tremendous opportunity in our state, which is really exciting.
I do want to ask you, Nick, about the way 5G is covered in popular media. Is it oversimplified? Is there something missing for audiences to understand it better?
Well, I think you're starting to get the sense that it's actually a really complicated set of things. I like to think of it as being six key aspects of a system. There are performance targets that are set at the international level to call something the fifth generation, for example. Then there are standards that specify how do you build a 5G system so that a base station from company A can interact with a smartphone from company B. Then there's the radio spectrum, which is the sort of the natural resource that enables wireless communication. And each country allocates spectrum for 5G in different bands and at different times over different, scales. There's the products, there's the services, there's the applications. So 5G means a lot of things. And so one thing I notice in the popular media is that it tends to get oversimplified in order to get a quick soundbite or a quick story out. And sometimes it takes a little bit more nuance to understand what some of the subtleties are.
Yeah, I think I'm just now getting it when you just said fifth generation. Is that what 5G stands for?
Yes.
And it's interesting because in my head, I've been thinking that these are some kind of new technology every time. It's like the 1G, then they made up something new and it's now 2G. I didn't realize these are just generations maybe it's different iterations of the same thing. Is that fair to say?
There are pretty significant shifts in the technology across generations. Ironically enough, the fifth generation technology is being specified by an organization called the Third Generation Partnership Project. So some of the naming is perhaps not that forward looking, but the idea has traditionally been, and I would say for the last several major generations, there's a notion of releases in this standards body. And within each release, you will see feature enhancements of one or more of the underlying technology generations. So from 3G to 4G, there was a very significant change in the way that the radio signals were modulated and encoded and transmitted. There's less of a dramatic shift from 4G to 5G in terms of the what we call the physical layer, the format of the signals. That's pretty common, but there's some changes there. There's also some significant changes in the core network. And so it's really just a question of where the big what we call features are added in the system as it evolves over time.
If you're listening to the program, we're speaking with Nick Lenneman, Director of SpectrumX, Co-Director of the Wireless Institute and Professor of Electrical Engineering at the University of Notre Dame. And we're also speaking with Meng Chang, Executive Vice President of Purdue University and Dean of the College of Engineering, about 5G technology, how it affects us, and the conversations surrounding it. If you have any questions or comments and Want to reach out to our guests? You can reach out to us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. Again, that number is 866-476-3881. Among, you mentioned earlier something about, like, with the changing technologies, you know, you every time something new comes out, then you have to buy new devices and upgrade your equipment. Is that the case with 5G? Do we all have to go now and get phones that are 5G compatible, or can we stick with 3G, 4G?
No, yes. Well, Mariam, I'm still on 4G phone, by the way. Sometimes, you know, my family jokes that, hey, you know, you work on 5G, so why don't you use 5G yourself? There are 5G compatible phones out there, you know, Dad. So I say, well, yeah, but, you know, this old iPhone still works, so I'm okay with it. Now, I think that there's always backward compatibility, and every operator would normally support at least one, sometimes two generations back. And this is part of their cost structure, right? That's why maybe sharing spectrum and infrastructure can reduce this accumulation of costs for them. And to consumers, I would say, look, you know, if you do want higher throughput speed and better responsiveness, yes, why not? At some point, your battery is going to die so fast that you have to switch for that reason anyway. But I would say the key really is what new applications can only be supported by 5G. A lot of those are not consumer facing, but there are some. And there is also the societal side of this story. Nick mentioned a wonderful nonprofit initiative here in the heartland, and we're trying to do rural connectivity by using some aspects of 5G technologies. Can we beam in certain spectrum signals so that our farmers and kids in the farmhouses can also do remote learning and enjoy the benefits of high-speed connectivity? What about digital agriculture in our state? You know, at Purdue, we're building a new campus. It's called Discovery Park District, 460 acres right next to West Lafayette Main Campus. And we're turning that into a lab to life. Any companies, innovators can come here and try to find a way to work with the commercial deployment opportunities we're offering here in different use cases. I'm a big believer that let the rubber hit the road, let applications derive values so that enterprises, consumers, and others will find it a motivating reason to purchase new equipment and devices.
Well, speaking of new equipment and devices, Nick, what kind of phone do you use?
Full disclosure, I have an iPhone 12 that supports 5G. Unfortunately, the 5G coverage in South Bend is not what it is in Indianapolis, but nevertheless, I'm doing just fine.
When I've seen like that signal come on my phone when it says 5G, does that mean I'm on this 5G network that's somewhere out there?
Yes. Well, typically, assuming that the carrier and the phone manufacturer is using the right characterization. Sometimes there's little wrinkles here and there. The marketing folks can get a little generous. In the early days, they were being a little bit generous with the 5G moniker on at least one or two phone models. But I think that's dialed in now.
Is using 5G more expensive in the long run? Every time when these things are updated, does it cost us more? Obviously, we have to update our equipment, but are there any other costs that we have to carry over?
Costs for whom? For consumers? For the carriers?
I would say probably for both, like on different sides of this.
The way I like to think of this is that by monetizing, so the carriers make significant investments in radio spectrum and in network infrastructure, and of course in their workforce to provide these services. But as use grows and as the numbers of applications grow, they get an economy of scale. And my phone bill has been pretty constant for some years now in terms of my cost at the end of the day, but the feature sets, the performance of the phone, I have upgraded the phone periodically, and that's an investment that I've made. I've chosen to make. And but in terms of the monthly service fee, it's been about the same. It's pretty remarkable.
Right. So on this note, you know, I think that here in the United States, in most cases, the consumers pay a fixed fee, but there are also many countries around the world where they pay based on usage. And normally when they go from one to the next generation, the older generation will be put on a flat fee plan, but the new generation will be more usage-based. But there are what people call smart data pricing solutions that can help you to reduce the cost to consumers. That is, when you shift over to a new generation and pay as you go in other parts of the world.
On that note, Meng, do you think that we're ahead in the U.S. when it comes to the development of 5G and high-speed networks, or are we behind?
Well, you know, I'll say from an innovation angle, yes. American engineers are still ahead of the rest of the world. Now, I'm a bit biased, but I think so. Now, from a deployment point of view, however, we are behind. We have been behind. We still are behind. Part of that is the spectrum issue. Even when spectrum is allocated and bidded and purchased by telecom operators, they are not allowed to use some of that in some cases. Part of that is the permitting and approval process to deploy smaller cells for 5G. But I'm hopeful that we can pick up the speed and deploy much faster in the coming few years.
Nick, I want to get a little bit of info on spectrum. I know both of you have talked about this a little bit, but for our listeners to understand what you mean when you say that.
Sure. So the way that a signal propagates from your phone to a base station or vice versa is via a propagation mechanism that's generally called electromagnetic waves. And it tends to be, for these systems, it works in a portion of it's called the electromagnetic spectrum. And radio waves are what are propagating from the one device to the other. So if you are driving in your car, you're listening to this radio station today, you're tuned into a particular frequency, probably somewhere between 88 megahertz or 88 million cycles per second, and 108 megahertz. These wireless signals for 5G and beyond are operating at much, much higher frequencies, sometimes a factor of 1,000 higher. With wider bandwidths. And so I like to think of bands of radio spectrum like lanes on a highway that allow you to convey information in this case. And so for 5G, we have a number of bands that have been allocated for 5G services in the US. And, you know, as demand grows, we need to allocate more and more spectrum in order to support more and more users that are gobbling up more and more data. And enabling more and more applications. So it's really the lifeblood, the physics and the lifeblood of these networks and the technologies around them.
Meng, when it comes to these the spectrum and these radio signals or frequencies? Is that accurate?
Yes, indeed. A range of frequencies, just like this very FM radio station operates on a particular frequency.
So who ultimately owns these radio frequencies? Is it the government? Is it private entities?
Well, most of that is a national asset. And the FCC, Federal Communications Commission, is the U.S. federal government agency responsible for deciding the policy of allocation. Some of these frequency bands are unlicensed, so pretty much anyone can use it. Like most of our Wi-Fi spectrum are unlicensed frequency bands. But as Nick said, that we are trying to go to higher frequency bands, wider frequency bands. And there are some pretty sweet spot frequency bands that are in contention right now. Say the FAA-FCC disagreement on a particular frequency, right? So I think it would be very useful for this country, our country, to release as much and as fast as possible spectrum or frequencies so that we deploy 5G faster.
And that's interesting. So that's up to the federal government to release that.
In most cases, there are some rules and regulations on local conditions in how you share a particular licensed or unlicensed spectrum as well. But the vast majority of the spectrum we are looking at here are under the FCC agency's regulation.
Just ahead for the Friday recap, we will talk to a researcher who studies food addiction and learn why making healthy decisions doesn't always come down to willpower. If you have any questions or comments, you can reach out to us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. A reminder, this show is not live. I'm Miriam Soeb. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Soeb. Today is the Friday recap where we look back at some of our favorite conversations we had this week. For our final segment, we'll talk to a researcher who studies food addiction to learn why making healthy decisions doesn't always come down to willpower. Let's take a listen to our conversation with Ashley Gearhart, Associate Professor of Psychology at the University of Michigan and Director of the Food and Addiction Science Treatment Lab. We're talking about food addiction and ultra-processed foods. And right before the break, we touched upon obesity and its relation to ultra-processed foods. We'll continue there and then get into some other discussion.
When we look at this, obesity is something that we weren't even tracking as a public health problem in the 70s. It was relatively rare, so we just weren't concerned about it, to a point now where 40% of adults have obesity. If we add overweight in there, it's actually about 75% of individuals who have overweight or obesity. It's now the dominant strain of what it's like to be in this food environment. To me, that screams that it isn't about an individual per se. You know, we are all responsible and need to make actions that support us, but we need to be in an environment that actually gives us a chance to succeed. It strikes me that it's really about changes in our environment that have led us to this point. And it has, you know, these stark issues for us of what does it mean as a society. The healthcare cost of diet-related disease are going to be a huge concern for us on an economic policy level. And when we look at even military readiness, you know, the younger generation is so unhealthy in large part due to diet and the impact of these ultra processed foods that more and more people are getting, aren't available to enter the military because their health is not at a level where they could join the armed forces. So it's really impacting us in ways that we really aren't even fully aware of in our day-to-day life.
Ashley, not to disparage any specific food choices out there, I've definitely tried so many different types of diets. But one thing I've noticed while trying to make my own healthier choices is that things advertised for vegetarians or vegans or keto friendly are often processed foods themselves. So it'll be like chips with protein, but they're still chips. And I've often felt when I've tried these different things, I'm just eating snacks all the time because it's a lot easier.
Absolutely. And you know, if you're interested in this sort of work, Michael Pollan has done some of the foundational popular press books on this. And he really says, you know, don't trust anything with a health claim, you know, because you don't see like your apples or your, you know, carrots or things like that having this big advertising of like, you know, fat-free food. Like I always laugh when I see gummy candy, like those Swedish fish. And it's like a low-fat food. Often a lot of these nutritionism sort of claims that are on these ultra-processed foods are about confusing the consumer to really think about the fact that this isn't a real food, that it's a chemical concoction that's designed to really activate your reward and motivation systems in a way that is really novel. And we don't, we're seeing the consequences of that. And so for me, it's really been helpful, again, to think of these, you know, ultra processed food substances as not in the same category with food. And when you look at those labels and there's, you know, ingredients and things on them that you can't even understand, you can't even pronounce, to just think about it with more skepticism. I'm not saying that, you know, the only thing people should subsist on is this black and white diet where, you know, you're only eating, you know, black beans and kale and that's it. You know, that's not what I think we need to take to heart per se, but that it is that, you know, the majority of our diet, the kind of default of our diet should be real food. And that we should know when we are eating these foods, even if they have all these health claims on them, to treat them with a skeptical eye towards their potential health consequences and their potential addictive nature.
What about alternatives to things like sugar? over the years, I've gone down the rabbit hole of, oh, we're going to use agave or maple syrup or coconut sugar. But is sweetness just sweetness? And it doesn't really matter where it comes from. It's still going to be addictive.
Yeah, the brain, you know, really, there's maybe a little bit of differences here and there. Like there's some evidence with high fructose corn syrup, the way it impacts the liver is particularly damaging. But at the end of the day, when it comes to the reward centers of the brain, you know, caloric sweeteners just make our brain sit up and pay attention. You know, we come out of the womb liking sweetness and finding it powerful. You know, we're designed to want that because it really encouraged us to consume, you know, our mother's milk and make sure we survived. You know, sugar is so powerful when you're a baby that we actually use sweet taste to replace opioids for some minor surgeries for babies. You'll give them a little dose of sugar and it's so effective at, you know, releasing opioids in the brain that they'll use it for circumcisions or shots or minor dental surgeries for young kids. And so kind of, yeah, whether it's, you know, a coconut sweetener or agave or whatever, at the end of the day, you know, added sweeteners and other, you know, refined carbohydrates are something I pay a lot of attention to because, you know, things like processed flours and starches that are really processed, that just gets converted into sugar in your body. And so when we're getting sugar from something like a banana or an apple and those naturally occurring products, it comes with fiber and waters and acids, and it doses and it ways that it's delivered so slowly that the body can handle that and the brain can handle that. But as soon as it starts to be stripped out and refined and then put in these packages that are not only, you know, higher amounts of sugar, but then you're often combining them with fat, which that doesn't happen in nature. You know, foods don't come high in both fat and sugar in nature. That is an evolutionarily novel, unique, highly rewarding package. And all the stuff that is protective, like the fibers and the waters, they're stripped out. And then the foods are so processed and texturized that they're almost pre-chewed for us. Think about, you know, how much longer it takes to chew an apple versus kind of a chocolate chip cookie you get out of a box. You know, it just kind of melts on the tongue and it gets into your system so much more rapidly. And all those features are what makes them enticing, appealing, makes us buy more, but also sets us up to lose control of them.
So would it be fair to say that somebody that is struggling with kicking junk food, it's not completely in their control?
Yeah, I would say if you're really struggling, you know, we need to think about in the same way we would with something like alcohol or tobacco, that we know it's really an interaction between, you know, your own individual risk factors and the substance itself. So, you know, not everybody who drinks alcohol develops an alcohol use disorder problem. You know, it's about 15%, 10 to 15% of people develop an alcohol use disorder. You know, we're seeing with our science that about 15 to 20% of individuals develop an addictive response to these foods where they're losing control, can't stop even though they want to, having these really intense cravings, and that it's really a struggle. And that I think with food, we so often just stop with, you know, calories in, calories out, you know, just try and white knuckle it, which it's a more complex psychological process that has a lot to do with reward and a motivation and emotions, and that you might need some additional support of a professional or a support group to help you really get to a point where these foods aren't starting to control your life.
How do we regulate foods here in the U.S.? And is that part of our problem that we have with some of these ultra processed foods and the way things are targeted?
You're very hands off in the U.S. Like we think about maybe some toxins here or there, but in general, when it comes to, you know, added sweeteners, added fats, our regulatory agencies have been very hands-off. And because of, you know, our focus on free speech, you know, there's minimal marketing restrictions, also about the kind of claims they can make about, you know, their foods, all these nutritionism, you know, claims about the healthfulness of the food. They're very underregulated. And we are seeing some countries starting to take steps to change the food environment that have been effective. Chile is probably one of the countries that's on the forefront that We won't let there be marketing on products that are, a certain food products that are not great for your health, that have really restricted marketing, that have changed, even taxing some of these foods in a way that is starting to really show benefits and their public health. The United Kingdom is making some huge strides where, you know, they're not allowing kind of any food marketing for foods that are unhealthy before 9 p.m. so kids aren't getting as exposed to them on television. It's going to take a multifaceted approach. No single approach or policy, and the same way we saw with tobacco, is going to be a silver bullet. But we can take a package of policies and supports to change the food environment in a way that kind of sets us up for health rather than, you know, these really out of control relationships that we have with food.
It's interesting when I've looked at foods from other countries, even snack foods or sweets, they will have ingredients that are, I guess, quote unquote, healthier. And they'll have things that aren't allowed in their products versus what we have here. Mm-hmm. And I've found that really interesting just because I'm like, we're America, right? Aren't we supposed to be like on top of things here?
Yeah, I would say the role of money in our political system really makes that challenging. You know, lobbying efforts, just like we saw with tobacco, are incredibly powerful at protecting the food industry from any sort of culpability for the effects of their products. And it's frustrating and it's concerning because, you know, the blame, just our narrative about why people are struggling, focuses so much on just shaming and blaming individuals. And it really doesn't take into account that there's a $1 trillion industry designing, engineering these products, marketing them aggressively with minimal government oversight. And that, you know, they're making money and making profit off this. You know, people want to be healthy. I've never treated somebody who has not tried everything under the sun to get their eating under control. And it's, you know, we're really, I think, putting the focus and the blame on the wrong sectors.
That's true. I think, before even having the conversation with you and not knowing so much about this, I used to think like, it's just willpower. And, you know, that's the message that everybody has. It's like, you either have it or you don't, or you need to find it. And then when learning more about just how things are designed and the addictiveness of it, it's just like, you feel like you're set up for failure.
Yes, it's, you know, I hate to like leave with such a sort of pessimistic message. So there are things people can do, but I do think as a whole, we need to ask for better. We need to ask our government to do better. We need to ask these industries to not put their profits and, you know, hold their profits as more important than the health of our children and our well-being. And I think there are things that we can do, but in general, I suggest that people treat themselves with a sense of like radical compassion that this is hard. Your brain is back in the Stone Age. It thinks it's going to die of famine at any moment. And our food industry is designed to take advantage of that. And so, you know, for folks, I really suggest taking many of the strategies that we use in addiction science to help them get a handle on their food as much as they can. And that's, you know, trying to really know what your cues and your triggers are. You're journaling about times of day, emotions, environments that are really tricky for you, and being really aware of those and trying to minimize your exposure to them, or coming up with alternative plans for how you can address them by having support or different coping strategies that aren't food related. And then, you know, I'll really suggest with people that I think one of the big approaches that I see sets people up to fail is that people will still be eating a lot of ultra processed foods, but just trying to eat very few calories. And so that triggers that fear of the body that it's starving. And that signal that you're so, so hungry goes up to the reward center of the brain and says, hey, pay attention. We need food. We need calories. And it makes us more vulnerable to those addictive foods. And so I really suggest to folks that they don't starve themselves, that they're focusing on eating real foods that they do enjoy and eating them regularly, you know, 3 meals, 1 or 2 snacks a day, and that they're not letting themselves get to those points where they haven't eaten all day. They're so hungry, they're tired, they're stressed, and they're sitting down on the couch with tons of food advertising. And then it often sets them up to lose control of their eating in a way that, just makes them really feel guilt and shame and then have to start all over the next day.
When it comes to the work that you are doing right now, I know you run the Food and Addiction Science Treatment Lab at the University of Michigan. Is there any new studies that you're looking into or things you could share with us?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, we're really focusing on kids is really important to us because, you know, most and you know, prior human history, we didn't really expose children to addictive substances as regularly, right? You know, you would maybe have your first exposure in adolescence, early adulthood. You know, if we think of these foods as having this addictive profile, you know, 80% of kids are having added sugars on a daily level. And so we really are trying to understand, you know, how are these foods impacting children even very, very early in life in a way that can be setting them up to struggle both psychologically and physically with these foods. And so, you know, again, to parents, I just add so much compassion to parents because it's really hard. And our environment is not set up for us to feed our children, to nourish them, but to feed them in a way that you profits the industry. And I think we need to understand that better so we can set up a world that lets our children have a healthier relationship with food.
Do you ever get pushback from these industries with the research that you're doing?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's, I think our messages are, you know, not ones that are appealing to the industry. My advisor in grad school is Kelly Brownell. And, you know, he kind of always told us that we really are going to have to make changes to improve our health that is not going to help the industry's bottom line. And so if you're doing stuff and that the industry isn't liking it and they're, you know, fighting against it to try and, you know, silence you or ridicule you, if anything, it probably tells you you're on the right track. And so I really kind of have paid attention to that idea of like, I'm going to follow the science and pay attention to what the science tells us. You know, try and hold strong on what would, I think, set us up to thrive rather than worry so much about what the industry thinks about what I'm doing.
Is there any other advice you'd give to listeners who are tuning in and just wondering what the first step they can take is to a healthier life?
I guess I've said this so many times, but I just see how much people are beating themselves up with just shame and guilt. And you know, I think the first step in many ways, it doesn't help you change often, is to you know, just be compassionate with yourself that this is really hard, that, you know, the environment has really been set up against us. And then to hold for yourself to say, okay, what sort of food nourishes me and that I do enjoy, but I'm not in this struggle with? And think about how do you make your own personal food environment as much as you can dominated by those foods and not letting the industry have such control over what's around you, and to, you know, approach some of those industry products with skepticism, to know that they're engineered to make it hard for you to consume those in moderation, and to kind of arm yourself with that information to figure out what works best for you.
Thank you so much for joining us. That's Ashley Gearhart, Associate Professor of Psychology at the University of Michigan and Director of the Food and Addiction Science Treatment Lab. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our Managing Editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song.